today on Ag News Daily.
15 years ago, I spent a lot of time trying to persuade and convince people that it was important to be able to talk about why they do what they do in farming.
Happy Friday here on the Ag News Daily podcast. Delaney Howell joined by my co-host Mike Pearson and Madison Hongtomp. And I'm glad Madison is taking it seriously today, Mike, because you and I are both sitting in our cars recording today's podcast. So if you hear the air conditioning running, it's because it's almost 90 degrees outside and I'm not going to sweat to death while we record the podcast.
Yeah, you know, I'm willing to give my all to this production, but I'm not willing to sacrifice my life for audio quality. That's just where I draw the line.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
You're just,
you know,
not
interesting, though.
Die hard.
I'm not. I fully admit it. I am a total, fair weather fan of the Ag News Daily podcast. And today is not fair weather. It is currently 86 degrees outside. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm in a friend's truck. And when you shut the truck off, it's a very new, very fancy. I feel we're very out of place driving it. But when you shut it off, it beeps. And the little screen on the dashboard says, check back seat for children or pets.
Hmm. Do you have any children or pets back there?
I'm not going to look until I shut the car off and I'm behind it. It'll be a surprise. It'll be a huge surprise if there's any children back there.
Well, yeah, I don't know what to say to that one, Mike. Did you offer some kids some candy?
Yeah, I'd have some explaining to do, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'd say so. Well, it definitely has been good weather across most of the Midwest. We're seeing planters finally roll. I think it's going to be interesting. Monday we get the crop conditions and the crop progress report, so it'll be fascinating to see what that shows. But I think, and Mike, you can maybe solidify this for me, the crop conditions report will only be on the acres that we've seen planted. It doesn't take into account the fact that there are still so many wet fields that haven't been planted yet, right?
Right. Yep. If the USDA officers, because it's the local offices that go out and compile these reports, mm-hmm. if they don't see corn, then obviously that corn doesn't count as having a condition. So if nothing has popped up, you know, if it was just planted this weekend or if it hasn't been planted yet, it will not get factored in. They will only look at the crop that is up. And, you know, Delaney, I'm going to be honest with you. So I had the chance to cruise across Illinois over the weekend, did not see many planted fields. The fields that I did see were spotty. There were definitely big, big wet spots. But all in all, not a lot of yellow corn, not a lot of, like, super obvious nitrogen leaching this early, which, honestly, I was really surprised by.
Hmm. So maybe the corn or soybeans that have gotten planted might be of okay quality?
I tell you what, from Grinnell, Iowa to Western Iowa, the places I've been cruising here recently, it looks halfway decent. I mean, the corn crop is ankle high, which is very bizarre to see for June 7th, but it's consistent stand, it's consistently green. I mean, I've got to imagine the crop conditions are going to be fairly favorable, which is something that, you know, might prompt a sell-off on Monday if that's what the USDA ends up reporting.
We will have to wait and see on that one, that's for sure.
Yeah, we will. Speaking of things we're going to have to wait and see, but we're making progress, President Trump said earlier today that there's a good chance that the United States will be able to reach a deal with Mexico over migration, perhaps before the tariffs go into effect, the 5% tariff on Mexico.
But those go into effect on Monday.
Yes. So it sounds like they're working today, and I guess they're going to work over the weekend.
That seems very un-Washington-y.
That's exactly what I thought. So don't think it's successful. Today they're on their third day, but they must be making progress. And Trump said, actually specifically, that they are going to begin purchasing farm and agricultural products at very high levels starting immediately. However, if they're unable to make the deal, then they will begin paying tariffs at 5% on Monday! Because that was a tweet.
Okay. Well, we will have to wait and see how the markets react to that on Monday if we don't get something put in place with Mexico.
Yes. Yes, we will. Won't be favorable to the hog market, which we saw today, in fact.
Yes. Absolutely.
But, Madison, what news is jumping out at you today?
Well, I have one thing that I saw that really jumped out at me about pesticides, and I know this was a huge topic, especially in the news during all the lawsuits through dicamba and glyphosate. But basically the EPA is, this is actually through the 2018 Farm Bill, kind of solidified this process that they're working on to evaluate the impact of pesticides on endangered species and their habitats. So this will be interesting to see kind of how this plays out. EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler did kind of describe this as a broken process. It's not quite in its final stages yet, but the agency has over 600 pesticide registrations to review by 2022. So hopefully they can kind of find a way to get this rolling and, you know, kind of figure out how to kind of go through this process.
Well, 600 currently is the backlog?
Mm-hmm. More than. It doesn't give an exact number. It just says over 600.
Wow. Wow, mm-hmm. Yeah. Hopefully they can get something figured out.
Mm-hmm. Boy. Okay.
No, name any other business where you can be 600 products behind and still be employed, other than the EPA.
Really nothing.
I feel like there's something.
I mean, maybe podcasting, but
yeah,
other
you
than
can
that,
have 600 episodes.
Like real jobs? Probably not.
Hey, this is kind of a real job sometimes.
Well, real jobs you get paid.
Yeah, that's true, I do.
The intern gets paid.
The intern gets paid, yeah.
The intern is the richest of all the Agnews Daily staff members. We are doing it wrong, Delaney Howell.
I know, I'm aware.
Listeners, if you want to advertise and reach a great audience, we can help you out. Please, for God's sakes, call us at the Agnews Daily Podcast.
All right, shameless plug, Mike. I like it.
All right. Shameless plug.
Stickless plug. All right. Well, we know now that Farm Country will officially 100% get disaster aid money. We saw President Trump sign that into law yesterday. It is official. There is no backing out now. But Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue offered comments, especially for those folks in North Florida hit by Hurricane Michael, as well as parts of Georgia and others. He promised that there will be some accountability and that this will move very quickly to try and provide relief for those folks that have been waiting for over a year now for some of that money.
Well, good. Good. Yeah, I mean, they have. As I think our listeners know, as Delaney, at least as far as you know, I am an avid sailor. And yeah. I love to go down to the Gulf Coast of Florida, Pensacola, down, you know, and east of there, and the devastation was catastrophic. I've got some friends down there, mm-hmm. fellow yachtsmen like myself, and, you know, obviously that's on the coast. That's where the hurricane was strongest, right when it made landfall. But the amount of damage it did to timber plantations, to, you know, other crop ground there was devastating. So hopefully those folks will get their dollars.
I would really be interested to see, too, because this is coming, like I said, you know, basically a year later. When was Hurricane Michael? I can't remember. Was it last?
Hurricane Michael was last year.
Fall?
I think it was last year.
No, maybe fall of 2017.
Okay, well, it's been quite some time, so I would be interested to see a study that showed, you know, maybe there were some folks that were waiting or banking on this assistance package to hopefully get them through to the next year because they had so much crop destruction or whatever. I would be curious to see if there were folks that went out of business because they were waiting for some sort of assistance package and they didn't get one.
I'm sure those stories exist. Mm-hmm. You know,
I'm sure they do,
say, but
I know.
Positive they're out there.
That just makes me mad at the government. Frustrated.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to the Libertarian Party, Delaney.
I know.
I've got some interesting news. So while we're talking about government and its impact on people's lives, we saw action of how government can pervert people's perceptions of things today, this very day on Wall Street, as a matter of fact. We had a terrible job number come out this morning. There was a very sharp slowdown in U.S. job growth that was released this morning. But the stock market rose 1% today. Why, Delaney Howell? We got bad news.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to think what would be. I don't know. Why?
Because this made traders think that this will cause the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates.
Okay.
So rather than betting on the bad job news, we're saying, hey, the job news was so bad earlier today that perhaps this will prompt the Federal Reserve to not just pause rate hikes.
Yeah, to cut them.
Bring rate cuts back into the picture. And in fact, I was talking to our good friend Ted Seifert from Zaner earlier today on Twitter, and the Fed funds futures rates actually are currently pricing in several rate cuts through the end of the year.
Well, that's maybe a good and bad, because that does indicate, I think, that we're seeing an economic slowdown, if not recession.
Yep, it's not a recession. There's a very specific definition. I think we've got to see GDP growth shrink for two consecutive quarters to be a recession. But the fear is, you're exactly right, we could be headed in that direction.
Yeah, and that, of course, means agriculture feels that, too.
Well,
we kind of already are, you know.
Typically, during slowdowns in the broader economy, agriculture shines. Because the dollar takes a hit, which means that all of a sudden, exportable products, which we grow in agriculture, are worth more.
But how do you factor that in with trade conflicts with Mexico and China and Canada?
That's the wild card. That is the wild card. It only makes sense for export values to rise if we're actually exporting stuff. Right. And to do that, we need trade partners.
Well, it's all very fascinating stuff, nonetheless.
It is. I just thought that was an interesting factoid today.
I like it. Thanks for that factoid.
You're welcome.
looks like we might have...
Wishy-washy on facts, but factoids, that's where I should go.
Okay, well, good. Got another factoid for you when you talk about trade. It looks like the EU is in the final stretch of a trade deal with Mercosur, which is, of course, Brazil and Argentina. Said they are really in the final stages here to get something put into place here for a trade deal between those countries.
Like, how close does that mean?
I don't know. It doesn't give me a timeline.
Here, I feel like we've been talking about this for a hot minute.
I do, too.
All right. Well, you know, we're going to see the Brazilians and the Argentinians continue to be our main competitors on the global stage when it comes to agricultural exports, that's for sure.
Yep. That is for sure. I was going to say, the only other piece of news I had that I really wanted to make sure I shared today was just some more pressure USDA is getting because of all the wet weather and crappy weather conditions we've had for planting. We saw a bipartisan group of senators from the Corn Belt farm states basically work together to write a letter to appeal to USDA to ease restrictions on haying and grazing of cover crops that farmers usually plant ahead of their corn and soybeans. But this year they're asking for the USDA to allow a change to rules to allow livestock to graze on these cover crops instead, because they don't know for sure if they're going to be able to get a corn and soybean plant in the ground in some instances. And the current crop insurance rules bar harvesting or grazing of cover crops on prevented planting acreage before November 1st, but that's still quite a ways away, so they're asking them to reevaluate that rule and potentially make some changes to it.
That would be awesome. That would open up a ton of acreage for forage crops and be in tight supply, given the number of dairies I've spoken to, like we talked about yesterday, that might not get their corn crop for silage in the ground.
Yeah, I was talking to our good friend of the podcast, Gary Rasmussen, who's up there in the Upper country of Michigan, and he said that has absolutely been a problem up in their area.
Wow. Well, All right. Hey, USDA, if we've got any listeners over there with some pull, do this thing that is being asked of you.
Maybe Secretary Northey, if he still listens to the podcast periodically.
That's right. Undersecretary Bill, if you tuned in, let's swing the hammer and make this happen. Let's graze it. The other plus of grazing cover crops, I'm sure we will see a lot of tillage radishes go in the ground this year. It will cut down on the rotting radish stench come fall. it's a win-win. It helps consumers. They don't have to breathe in the smell of stinking radishes rotting in a, you know, tillable field, and cattle get to eat.
Well, there you go.
Win-win. All right.
I'm a solutions person. That is what
yeah.
I do. I'm
okay.
Solutions.
All right. Well, I'm out of news. Madison, Mike, you guys got anything else?
What you got, Madison?
I have one last thing. I thought this was a good, like, Friday piece to end on. So it's about the bees in Minnesota. You know, we got to save the bees. They are on the endangered species list now. But Minnesota lawmakers are making a new program to actually pay homeowners in the state to transform their lawns into bee gardens in efforts to counter the declining population. So they are going to allocate just $900,000 annually to support these homeowners interested in making their lawns more attractive to bees, specifically the rusty patched bumblebee, which is indigenous to North America. And I believe it is the bumblebee itself is the one bee that we need for pollination,
yeah.
For the most part, but it is the one that is declining the fastest.
Hmm.
And this program will actually cover up to 75% of expenses for homeowners to transform their lawns. And then in areas that are identified as high potential for the bumblebee, they will see up to 90% of their costs covered with this program. So this, I don't believe this is passed yet. It was just kind of introduced. But I thought that was a really kind of cool thing, especially, you know, in agriculture, we need that kind of pollination. And it's an important thing for the environment and all of that. So.
Absolutely. Minnesotans, hey, you're tuned in. If you live in an area with a yard and you want to be completely infested with bumblebees, check out this program. It sounds like a great way to really make sure your neighbor's children stay off your lawn.
Madison, I don't know. Madison, do you classify as a millennial or are you the next generation down?
I don't know what.
Okay,
I'm
well,
like,
that piece of news feels very millennial to me. Like, let's
yeah,
save
definitely.
The bees.
I'm like in that. I was born at the end of 99, so like I'm in the middle where
oh
I really don't classify it as either one.
The end of 99. You're almost a 2000
you're
baby.
A pup, Madison.
Oh, yeah.
That's what you're categorized as. Just a
oh, man. All right. Mike, why don't
all
you
right.
Rip this Band-Aid off the commodity markets here?
Let's do that. Let's tear this Band-Aid off. Folks, we have seen tremendous volatility this week. We've seen price swings to the upside, to the downside. That means the value of the commodities that you have in the bin or in the field has fluctuated greatly. Manage some of that marketing risk. Do it with our friends at Zander. You can give them a call at 312-277-0050 to get some advice on how to hedge your profits or perhaps your losses this year and minimize them. Give them a shout or visit them on the web at Zaner, Zaner.com. As Delaney said, for producers, this was a day in the red. In the corn market, July corn was down 4¾ cents at 4.15¾. The December crop was down 4¾ as well to close the day at 4.33¾. In soybeans, July was off 12½ cents at 8.56¼. November new crop down 12¼, finished the day at 8.83 even. And Chicago wheat, oh, ended its upswing. July down 5½ cents at 504 and a half. September down 4¾ to close the day at 509½. Jumping over to the world of livestock again, red on the screen, really led in a large part by the hog market. June live cattle down 67½ cents at 106.92.50. The August contract down $1.50, closed the day at 103.30. Feeder cattle, oof. August feeders down $2.25 at $137.25. September contract down $2.25, closed at $137.35. And in lean hogs, the July contract limit down the daily $3 trading limit at $83.35. August also limit down today, $82.62.50 was the close in that contract. looking at the dairy market, really the only green on the screen. In Class 3 milk, the June contract was up 4 cents at $16.26, with the July up 9 to finish at $16.64. Without further ado, we had a great conversation with Michelle Payne, who has written quite a bit about agriculture and especially our relationship to consumers and what we need to think about going forward.
For today's conversation, we're joined by Michelle Payne, who is a professional speaker and author for Cause Matters Corporation. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Michelle, tell us a little bit then. I want to know about the author side of things. What do you write about? Because obviously we like to talk to people involved in agriculture. So what are you writing about in some of your books and blogs and other discussions?
Sure. I actually work to try to connect people around the food plate. So pretty much everything from gate to plate is what I've used for the last 18 years. And I have written three books, No More Food Fights, which is a two-sided book, including a farm side. My last release was Food Truth, which came out, I believe, in 2013 with basically the 25 biggest myths about farming and food. And then in November of this year, I will release Food Bullying, which focuses on just that and how we've been bullying and making our food and eating choices with a lot of truths incorporated from the farm in that as well. So most of the focus of my work centers around helping people understand where their food comes from and why we do what we do on the farm, as well as sharing stories from across North America of how food is raised.
So, Michelle, how did you get into this? What's your background? What makes you such a compelling speaker and author?
Well, I must be crazy. I don't know. I started my business 18 years ago this month, actually, and I had been working for the National FFA Foundation and then had worked in international dairy genetics. So I sold semen and embryos as my first gig out of college and had a lot of fun with that. But throughout the course of my career and working with a lot of different agribusinesses, both large and small, and then farmers around the world, I pretty consistently saw that people didn't understand where their food comes from. That's very well known today. I think in the agriculture community, people accept that as the truth. But 18 years ago, I spent a lot of time trying to persuade and convince people that it was important to be able to talk about why they do what they do in farming. And I got into it because I was a farm girl from Michigan, and I was really tired of organizations like the Humane Society of the United States telling others how I should be treating my cattle. And so that started it all. And throughout the course of these years of speaking and now writing books, I've expanded my base to work with food, dietetic, health, and wellness groups as well. But obviously my first love is agriculture and working with farm audiences.
Absolutely. That's awesome, Michelle. So I assume in your work now with people outside of agriculture, you get to also speak at events where people maybe don't have a direct connection to agriculture. How do they react to some of the stuff when you're discussing what you've seen around connecting folks from, you know, maybe cities to the food on their plate?
Yeah, it's interesting because it varies a lot. I do work with a number of dietetic groups, and even in casual conversation, right? You know, it's almost funny because people will read or they'll listen and they say, "Well, this is just logic," and I say, "Yeah," and they're like, "Well, but it makes sense," and I say, "Yeah." And, you know, we kind of laugh about it. And, you know, I know people that are out there farming, particularly if you're frustrated right now, as most of us are, by this lovely weather and trade situation. I think it's easy for us to laugh at people that aren't from a farmer ranch. And it's easy for us to ask why people are asking so many questions or wonder why people are asking so many questions and get defensive. But it doesn't have to be that way because the reality is everybody is choosing food for their families. They have a right to ask questions. Just as much as we have a right to ask questions for the people that come out to our farms and ranches. So the reactions that I typically get, aside from, well, this is logical, are raised eyebrows. I will openly admit that there are some in the dietetic world who don't care for my work because they like to accuse me of being a paid hack and, you know, spokesperson for big agriculture and all of that good sort of stuff. Because I'm pretty clear in my support for modern agriculture and my support for all sizes and shapes of agriculture. And not everybody agrees with that, but I'm perfectly fine And I think what we can do is approach it as a conversation rather than being defensive and getting upset that people are asking questions.
So now let's talk about food bullying. This is your next book that's coming out. What is that, Michelle? What are you hoping to address?
What I'm hoping to address is the $5.75 trillion business of marketing food. When we go into a grocery store in the United States, there's an average of 40,000 products in those grocery stores. That's an impossible amount of food to sort through. And if you consider that there's an average of 5 claims, and that's just, you know, a thumbnail, 5 claims on every food product, that's 200,000 claims that we're supposed to sort through. So basically the premise behind food bullying is that we have been manipulated both psychologically and through our brains to believe that different types of food is supposed to be superior. It's the basis behind all of these claims such as clean and all natural and sustainable that really have no definition and therefore they have no meaning. They're not defined, they're not distinguishable. Food bullying also represents the fact that farmers sometimes bully each other and they sometimes bully consumers because they don't necessarily agree with their choices. One of the examples I offered happened to be from Nebraska and happens to be a friend who farms several thousand acres and has converted half of his acres to organic, certified organic, and he shared with me some of the different comments, shall we say, that other farmers have made to him that didn't know why he was doing what he was doing and weren't particularly supportive. So the reality is in today's time, we've sometimes lost our ability to think critically and have meaningful conversations with people that have different positions. So I wrote Food Bullying to try to help people do just that because I happen to believe that food is a basic necessity. It's at the basic hierarchy of our needs, if you will, and we need to learn to have a elevated food conversation.
I think that's definitely something that gets beaten into our heads a lot, too, is, you know, we have to be able to talk to folks. We have to be able to engage with them on a way or a platform that they understand and not feel like we're bullying them or making them feel guilty about their decisions. Michelle, can you give us a little preview of this book? I know it hasn't been released yet, your food bullying book, but give us a little preview about how we go about having those conversations with folks that don't understand how their food is being grown, maybe.
Sure. Well, the first thing that I will say is it's not easy. You know, I have registered Holsteins running around my front yard in their pasture right now. And when people start saying bad things about dairy farmers, I get defensive too. So I understand it. But the biggest ingredient that I always offer people is to find the common ground. So if you can find common ground as a sports fan, as a parent, where you went to college, whatever it may be. But within food bullying, what I try to do is to explain to people that they have been buying bull speak. And obviously the abbreviation for that is BS, but I am not offering up cuss words. It is bull speak. And try to offer to people, this is what the label is, this is reality, and how the product was produced, you decide. And I think we need to do more of that because the reality is whether it's choice on the farm or choice on the plate, we all have a right and a responsibility to make our own decision. And so I really try to offer up to people specific examples of this is what you have been told. If it comes without measurement, it comes without meaning. And this is the way that food is typically raised. These are the protocols. These are the requirements. If you don't believe me, talk to the folks that are out there doing it, the actual farmers and ranchers, and make your own decision.
And
so
you
I don't
mentioned
know
finding
– oh.
Sorry, no, Michelle. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying I don't know if that answers your question or not, Delaney, but that kind of gets to some of the heart of it.
I think so, too.
Yeah, and I guess I was going to say, once you build that common ground, once you find that thing that people can relate to as a person, how do you segue into the harder conversation? It's always that – I always struggle with that bridge between the, hey, look, we're buddies, to, look, this is what I do in the feed yard.
Yeah, exactly. So what I always do is suggest asking questions. Because I think that if you ask questions and you actually listen rather than preparing to respond, you have the opportunity to really get a gauge on where they're at. I never suggest that you lead with the most contentious issues, so I do not suggest that you necessarily lead with GMOs or animal welfare, depending on the person that you're with. And so I'll just ask questions, you know, once you establish that trust and that common connection. So, for example, my friend Eliz is a spokesperson for the American Heart Association, and we actually are going to be starting a podcast on food bullying together, because we would have weekly calls, usually FaceTime, so we could see each other, and she would ask me questions about food. And we usually got into arguments, I'll be clear, because we're very good friends. But what I would say is, okay, so what's the question? And if you're in a situation with someone you don't know as well, you could simply say, well, what are your concerns about food today? And let them lead the conversation rather than putting ideas in their head, because so often with our science background in agriculture, I think that we provide people with more information than what they actually want or need. Sometimes they just have a question about why we do what we do.
Yeah, maybe we're providing too much information sometimes.
Yeah, what I call it is dumping data or puking science on people's shoes.
I like that. And
a mom, seriously, a mom sometimes just wants to feel good that she's doing a good job and buying the right kind of food for her kid.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Michelle, before we let you go, how can folks find out more information about some of the stuff you're working on, or how can they get a hold of some of the books that you've written?
Sure. Well, the books, No More Food Fights, Food Truths, and Food Bullying are all available on Amazon, Walmart, Barnes & Noble. You get the drift. Food Bullying does release on November 5th, but I do have available for pre-orders, which means you can get them in October. But they're available now, and my website is causematters, causematters.com. You can connect with me through social media at mpainspeaker. That's mpainspeaker, if you can listen that fast. And I'm always delighted to connect with listeners. So please do ping me on any of the social channels or check out the website, order the books, whatever you wish.
Awesome. Michelle, thank you so much for sharing about some of what you do for agriculture today.
Well, thanks for having me, and keep up with the good work.
All right. Well, again, a big thank you to Michelle. Do check out some of her stuff if that's of interest to you. But also check out some of the great stuff we've got going on at globalagnetwork.com. We've got some good projects in the works for the summer. We've got Madison working very diligently on those. But do check out some of the other podcasts that are part of that network. We just launched a premier podcast looking at a marriage of agronomics and economics. So that is our latest one that launched there. I think it's pretty interesting stuff, but do check it out.
I do, too.
Yeah,
I'm a little biased, but I think it's fantastic.
You put in a lot of work on that, Mike. Good job.
I did. Check it out of pity, people. Let's check it out, listen to it, and I guarantee you will learn something as well.
Yeah.
And the future episodes are going to be even better.
That's right. Good plug.
The premier podcast at globalagnetwork.com, or you can find us on the internet at Ag News Daily on Facebook and on Twitter, or at agnewsdaily.com. All places will get you there. All roads lead to Rome, as they say. But folks, it's a Friday. Madison, should we let the people go?
Let's let them go.